Buddy, I'm Beattie Cohn-Vredos, and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And every week now, for almost 4 years, this has been my theme song, and I really hope that you take in the Beatles' very, very wise, wise lyrics. And that is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives, whether or not we're rich or poor, or gay or straight, or religious or not. Life's challenges are there for all of us, but the real question really becomes when things start to get really, really off track. And that's one of the issues, of course, is that what I have found in my practice, and I've been practicing now as a psychotherapist and sex therapist for over 35 years. And every time I say that every week, I can hardly even believe it. But the reality is that, you know, my patients tell me all the time, if only we had called you earlier, because people tend to wait a very, very long time if indeed they give themselves permission to reach out and ask for help. And I think a lot of people, they still feel that asking for help means that they are weak. And of course, I try to encourage all of you that it is a real strength to be able to acknowledge to yourself that life is not going well, that your relationships are in a state of chaos. For example, you know, worldwide, you may not know this, there are about 350 million people who are suffering from true clinical depression, 16 million adults in the United States, and that actually translates into 1 in 5 Americans. And you also may not be aware of this, but anxiety disorders, panic disorders of various different kinds have now taken on the number one mental health issue in the United States. We have 40 million adults who are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And I don't want to depress you, but if we are looking at relationships, and today we are going to be talking about divorce, but if we're looking at domestic violence, and October happens to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month, there are 3 women that are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner, and 4 women are abused in their lifetime. 4 women in relationships. So I think that, you know, what is the message? The message is that we have to be very, very careful who we let into our lives. And I'll tell you a cute little story that happened this week. I won't mention the university because they may decide then to not book me, but I was talking to the coordinator. I was going to be going to a university and talking about domestic violence issues. And I happened to say to the coordinator, I said, look, my research, my book, I've discovered over the years that there are actually 3 things that people need to do so that we will never make a mistake in love again. And of course, number one, each of us, we need to make sure that we are in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And even though we cannot change history, we cannot change the family that we grew up in, we cannot change the abuse that we may have had to endure as a child or as as an adult growing up, there is absolutely a way that we need to find, and most people actually do need to seek outside help if they are working through a variety of different kinds of trauma. But we can be very, very successful in emotionally working through as best as we can, even though we cannot change what did or did not happen in our earlier lives, to work through these demons, to work through these issues so that we are finally, once and for all, able to live in the moment without having 1 foot in the past and 1 foot in the present. And if we are looking for the fairy godmother to bring the prince or to bring the princess into our lives, hoping that that person is going to make everything better for us, we have a lot to learn. I wish that it were the truth, but unfortunately, as I used to tell my my daughter Jordana when she was a teenager. I used to say, Jordana, the relationship needs to be the icing on the cake. And we need to be solid. We need to be the foundation. So that's number one. And then, of course, number two, we each have a responsibility to learn what ingredients actually go into a healthy, long-lasting relationship. And for those people who were unlucky and they did not see healthy family functioning, we cannot go back and say, oh, well, we were not lucky, and therefore we give ourselves permission to continue to go through this cycle of dysfunctional relationships. We need to learn. We need to read. We need to take courses. We need to perhaps seek out some professional help so that we have clarity within ourselves about what we should be looking for and what we should not be tolerating ever in our relationships. And of course, number three, I talk about my book all the time, and the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love, with my research with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, and Boston area. I actually devised a 10-step formula that teaches all of us how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. So when I was having this conversation with the coordinator, she was saying to me, well, the students, they don't want to be told what to do. And, you know, I was thinking on the other end of the line, that's part of the problem. That's part of the problem is that how many people are really wanting to learn the ABCs of healthy relationships? How many people are actually really serious about doing what we need to do to have and to maintain really good physical health over and above emotional health? But yet people, they make choices. And if you don't want to do the work, and if you don't recognize that there is actually a learning curve for all of us when it comes to relationships, when it comes to getting our own lives together, then unfortunately we do have to suffer the consequences. And of course, if we're looking at our physical health as well, there's so many things that we need to do. And of course, Gary Null, he talks about intentional neglect and intentional ignorance in every day on his show right here on the Progressive Radio Network. He talks about the importance of vitamins and supplements and plant-based foods, and talks about things that we all need to actually do if we are going to have really wonderful physical and emotional health. And, of course, there are many, many people. There are millions of people that listen to his show, and there are million people around the world who talk about having a healthy type of a lifestyle. And yet, you know, it's the follow-through. It's the follow-through that really, really does make the difference. We talk about exercise and weight training, and I'll hear all the time. The people will tell me, well, we know about the studies, and we know that you can live longer. We know that exercise is really good for your blood pressure and your cholesterol and your heart, and it is a tremendous, tremendous antidepressant. And yet, you know, people will find a lot of excuses. You know, we don't have the time. It's too hard. I'm too lazy. I want to watch a television show. And again, we actually do, unfortunately, have to take responsibility, or we do suffer the consequences. And of course, the importance, and I talk about this all the time as well, about having really supportive people in your life. And once a year, I used to ask audiences to take a look at who stays and who goes. And I'm not suggesting that you just toss people out of your life. Obviously, you try to negotiate and problem solve and have effective communication and see whether or not compromise and trade-offs and a win-win solution and resolution is possible. But if it is not toxic people will kill kill us in one way or another, just like toxins in our environment will. So think about the people who are actually in your life right now. Are these people who bring out the best in you? Or are these people who, if you're really, really being honest with yourself, they really make you crazy? And that includes family as well. And if we're going to live, really productive lives, constructive lives, and happy lives, again, there are certain things that we actually need to do. And if you need that extra help, that extra push, that extra person to take you by the hand and help you to stay on course on a really constructive path, then you need to give yourself permission to do exactly that. Well, today, I have a guest, and we are going to be talking about divorce. Now, my guest actually contacted me through a Psychology Today profile that I have on the internet, and I was really impressed. Because any lawyer who is looking at Psychology Today, reading Psychology Today, who is interested in therapists who work with couples and who are engaged in a lifelong pursuit of helping people is someone that I really wanted to meet. So Dan Stock and I, we had lunch a week ago. And not only was I impressed with his obvious expertise and experience, which I'm going to tell you about in a moment, but I left saying to myself, look, I feel really comfortable with this man. And if I have patients, patients need to feel that they're going to be heard, that they're going to be understood, that they're going to be with somebody who is empathic. And I thought, this is definitely a man who I would feel comfortable referring to and really wanted to have on the show. So Dan, welcome, welcome.
Thanks, Beattie. Great to be here.
Yeah, and for those of you who are listening right now, Dan has amassed more than 20 years' experience as a divorce lawyer in New York City and Westchester. And during that time, Dan has handled every conceivable type of divorce case, from the most basic to complex high net worth international divorces. And in addition to being a matrimonial trial lawyer, Dan is a collaborative divorce attorney, meaning that you work with people like me, taking cases where a mediated, softer approach is called for. And I was also really happy to see that you also handle gay divorces. So you've been doing this a long, long time.
A long time.
A long time. So I want to know, what changing trends have you seen in the world of divorce in the past 20 years since you started?
Well, in the early days, it was not uncommon for women to go into divorce totally blind to all of the things and problems that their husbands were about to throw in their way. And I think what's changed the most is the access to information that women now have and how to protect themselves in divorce. Having said that, there's a lot of misinformation out there, which is where I come in. And
such as what? What kind of misinformation
we
have?
Probably the biggest piece, and I've written about this, is that a lot of women in divorce feel that there's no way they can afford to go out, hire an attorney, especially if their husband has been the primary wage earner in the marriage. They're very paralyzed by this, and they don't need to be, because we've got laws on the books that address that, and there are ways for women to get through divorce financially.
I want to ask you, the majority of clients who call you, are they men or are they women? Because during our lunch, you were saying that there's a real difference that you have found between men who are seeking you out and women and the trauma and the struggles that they're going through.
Right. So statistically, women are more likely to initiate divorce proceedings than men are. The two groups need, my experience, and I think most of my colleagues, have to be handled in so many different ways, and this is why I've integrated my practice and reached out to therapists over the years, because women in divorce and men in divorce are going through very, very different psychological states. And these ideas that they have and their feelings about divorce and their anxieties about divorce translate into the legal scenario. So unless I understand what is bothering women and what is bothering men, I'm not going to be an effective divorce attorney for them. So I've made it my business to understand best as I can, not being a psychologist, what are the hot spots in divorce for men and for women.
What are the hot spots and what are the differences between the two?
Right. So women are very much concerned, and by the way, it is not strictly gender-based and it can cross lines, but as a group, in my experience, women are extremely concerned about how they're going to function post-divorce, how they're going to raise their children, how they're going to have money to raise their children, how they're going to support themselves. You find this especially in long-term marriages where there's been an economic partnership between husband and wife, and that gets dissolved very quickly. And this is a major concern. And also what is going to happen with who's going to get custody of their children. So those are the tremendous hot spots for women. Men, on the other hand, who have been high wage earners, are very, very concerned about the money and the wealth they've accumulated during the marriage. It could be a business, it could be stock holdings, it could be land, it could be property, it could be exotic race cars. I had a case a couple of years ago where I had a husband with $1 million race car collection, and I had to figure out, you know, how my client, who was the wife, was going to get part of that, and she wound up doing exactly that. So men are very concerned that what they've labored for their entire lives is about to disappear from them.
But my understanding has been, I mean, I've lived in New York now for just 4 years, and I was in Florida before that, and of course in Canada for most of my life. I thought it was pretty clear, though, that it's a 50-50 split, and that in terms of custody, that it is joint custody. So you're saying that it is a lot more complicated than that, especially in long-term marriages.
Yeah, it's not only more complicated, but there's a lot of misconceptions about who gets what and who's entitled to what. I wish it were that easy, that men and women could come to divorce lawyers and divorce judges and put their cards on the table and split up their assets and have an intelligent parenting plan where they were going to raise their children and so forth. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. Litigation model is pretty much all we have right now in terms of getting people divorced. And once you enter a lawsuit, there are some things that take over which are not really good for people emotionally. And it's another reason why it's important to have a good divorce lawyer and his team at your disposal when you're going through this. So yeah, even though at the end of the day, which may be years after divorce starts, and we've all heard the horror stories, the split of assets and the split of children in terms of parenting time is roughly 50-50, especially in a long-term marriage, getting from A to Z is often a big problem.
But I would suspect that you say that. I mean, people have an option. They, as you say, they can spend years and years and spending, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the courts. But if you say to somebody, which I suspect that you would, look, in the final analysis, just like you said right now, it's going to come out that it's probably going to be close to a 50-50 split. So that's stop this whole process that is going to completely get out of hand. And that's just agree to 50-50.
Well, now we're entering into your area, Beatty, which is what drives divorce emotionally. And it's been said that divorce is a financial decision wrapped inside an emotional nightmare.
Yes.
And that's really true. And the problem that people find is that even though at the end of the day, they're going to wind up pretty much close to splitting assets 50-50 in New York, we use the word equitable. which is fair, equitable distribution, right. Which is not necessarily 50-50. The problem is that people in divorce, just like people in life, take entrenched positions, which are not always calculated to be win-win, which means getting divorced faster, cheaper, less strenuously, less stressfully. So even though that's the ideal, once emotions enter the picture, people are likely to have a different attitude. For the man, he might say, well, okay, let me see if I get this straight. I've worked my whole life. I've built this company from the ground up. I'm not willing for somebody to take half of it. It's not fair. And a woman who's primarily raised her children might be an absentee husband, might be a husband that travels for work all the time. She may not be willing to say, okay, well, now you can come back into the picture. I wrote an article on this called Daddy Come Lately. And okay, that's fine, and you'll have the children half the time. So they're moving from opposite poles, and it sometimes takes time to make them reach a middle ground.
But if people end up in awful kinds of litigation, I mean, what does the judge, in a situation like this, let's say it's a relatively long-term marriage, long-term meaning 10 years or more, right? How would the judge rule? I mean, would the judge not rule basically 50-50 and joint, joint parenting?
Right. Okay. So we get into that area about how each divorce case is like a snowflake. They're all different. And even though under perfect conditions, the judge would say, well, okay, nobody here has done anything wrong, underhanded, illegal even to jeopardize the other spouse or even the children. That would be an ideal case. The reality is that in every case, almost every case, either the mom or the dad or the husband and the wife has done certain things which the judge has to figure out with the help of the lawyers to find out what is fair to both parties. For example, let's say the man has taken money from the marriage and done away with millions of dollars, or maybe he's shipped it offshore or overseas, and this comes out during the divorce. Well, what's left of the marriage, let's say, is not much in terms of cash. Is it fair under those facts for the judge to say, okay, well, you know, you guys have got $10 left, let's split it down the middle and, you know, have a nice life?
Absolutely not.
Not so much.
Not in that situation.
Right. And what about parents who have substance abuse problems and have placed their children in danger? I was involved with a case not long ago where that was the case, and actually both parents had substance abuse problems, and it was a very, very interesting case where the judge had to almost pick between two not quite perfect parents, and even then the judge ordered a certain amount of therapeutic supervision in the case. So you have all these factors, and actually that's the way the laws are written. The laws actually require the judges to take into account the behavior of the parties, not only during the divorce, but during the marriage as well.
Mm-hmm. And do judges these days, do they care about affairs?
Right. So not so much anymore. That's actually another change that's come down in the last 20 or so years. Extramarital affairs are a part of, in my experience, most divorces, infidelity affairs, affairs with babysitters and nannies and au pairs. The list goes on.
Women as well as men now.
Yeah, women as well as men. Although I have to tell you that in my experience, men are more likely to have affairs extramaritally than women are. And the attitude toward the courts is basically, we have a child-centric model in terms of what's best for the children. And so long as an extramarital partner does not present any danger to the welfare of the children in the marriage, then basically the rule is it's not objected to, in other words. And we don't, although we do still have adultery laws on the books. I think the last prosecution for adultery in New York State was 55 years ago. Mm-hmm. So And although New York has no fault, it did keep the other grounds for divorce, including adultery. It rarely, if ever, these days enters the picture. And again, the test is whether or not an extramarital affair has had some negative effect on the children. Otherwise, it has essentially no effect. It has no effect at all on property division and divorce.
Uh-huh. Well, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think we've come a long way.
I think so. The system isn't perfect, but it's moving. Law has a tendency to move at a glacial pace, and at least in that area, we've made some progress.
No, and that's a really positive thing. Now, when men and women, if you can make a generalization here, are coming to see you, what reasons are they giving you for their wanting to end their marriage?
Right. Well, by the time they get to me and my colleagues, there's already been enough of a breakdown in the marriage or the relationship where they want legal help separating themselves out. So what do I mean by legal help? If it's a marriage, there are custody and child support and alimony, we call that maintenance in New York, issues to be dealt with. Women as a group, but men also obviously need to know what they're going to be paying or receiving in the way of alimony going forward. They need to know what property division is going to be made. They need to know what arrangements are going to be made for custody. Who gets the last say in terms of custody? Does a judge order it? Can the husband and wife agree on it? So it's really everything that's affected their entire marriage, from finances to education for the children to child support. Really what they're doing is they're coming to you with their life savings and life stories and saying, okay, we're done, but I don't understand legally what's going to happen from this point on. Please tell me, and then please do whatever is necessary.
So you find then that in the vast majority of situations, the people who come to see you are actually done. They are done trying. They are done seeking counseling. If they've done that at all, they're finished.
Right. By and large, they're finished. You always get a small number of cases every year where they'll come in for a consult and then they'll reconcile. But I have to say, by the time they get to the lawyers, they're pretty much done. And whether or not they get to a lawyer in time to protect themselves against certain things that may have already started happening to them is a separate question. And it's one of the reasons I reach out to therapists is that I want therapists who are treating people who are about to go through a divorce to know that delay is usually not a good thing on either side. If it's a question of custody or money or division of assets, one side usually doesn't play fair, and that's the problem. It's often the man, but not always. And the sooner people realize that they need to get a consult with a divorce lawyer, the better. And one of the great things in my career and experiences I've had over the last 20 years with therapists is that therapists today are much more aware of the legal issues that are affecting clients that come to them for psychological counseling. When I started doing my outreach work to therapists 20 years ago, a lot of therapists were not really that aware of the legal pitfalls that their clients would bring in with them. And it's been one of the most gratifying parts of my career to see the increase in awareness in therapists.
So how do you work with therapists?
Right. So I work with therapists in the collaborative divorce setting primarily, in that collaborative divorce was started in 1990 as a system of getting people divorced without resort to courts or litigation. And it involves mediation techniques, a teamwork approach. Typically, the setup is a lawyer for each spouse, a divorce coach, which is what a therapist turns into after they get special training in collaborative divorce, and a financial neutral. And it's a teamwork approach. People sit around a table. Everybody has to sign a contract to say that they're not going to do anything underhanded or deceptive, and that they're going to give up certain of their rights to try their case in a court of law. And that was the first time that I worked with therapists.
See, that's really interesting, and I'm curious, what percentage, I mean, I would think that ideally that would really be the way to go. Now, what percentage of your clients and people in your firm actually opt for this collaborative divorce approach,
well,
which is so sane?
It really is a great way to get divorced. And unfortunately, in the New York metro area, which of course is where I practice, about 5% wind up going the collaborative route. And I think that would be not inaccurate to say for the rest of my colleagues. If you go upstate, it's more popular. And there are some states like Michigan and California where this has really taken off. My personal belief is that in the future, collaborative or some variation of it is going to be the only way people get divorced. But right now, we still have mostly a litigation model.
Why do you think that it's so low? And do you suggest it? I mean, when people come in to see you, do you say, look, you know, we can do this, we can try to do this well, or this can end up being yet another battle for you?
Right.
The percentage is so low.
Right. And great question. So my belief, aside from being an attorney that upholds all of the ethical rules that we're all bound by as attorneys, is that every case has to be judged and handled on its own merits. In other words, people deserve to have the kind of divorce that is applicable and appropriate to their own particular situation. I certainly hope none of my colleagues views divorce clients as interchangeable parts where they can earn a certain fee if they do things a certain way and a different fee if they do things a certain different way. So in collaborative divorce, or let me say this about clients, I will always analyze a client's case with a view toward the dispute resolution technique that's most applicable and fair and less invasive for their particular case. There are some cases that absolutely need to be litigated in a court of law because the other side has done things, including illegal things, that my clients need to be protected from. However, there are other people who like a more civil and civilized approach to divorce, and they're perfect for collaborative. And I will recommend that they go the collaborative route. Why it hasn't taken off to this point is a bit of a mystery. It may involve the finances of running a law practice in New York City.
Exactly. Yes. I mean, it's probably much, much less lucrative for attorneys law firms to have a collaborative divorce approach.
You know, collaborative's been around about 25 years now, and they've actually done some longitudinal studies on it, and they found that the average length of a collaborative divorce case is probably about 25% that of a normal litigated case. So the amount of time it takes is a lot shorter. And as a byproduct of that, as you would imagine, the amount of legal fees that it costs to put through a collaborative divorce is a fraction of what it is in litigated divorce. So the length of so-called average divorce really isn't any such thing, but it's not unusual to have litigation divorces last anywhere from 18 months up to north of 4 years. That is just a terrible way to get divorced, in my opinion, and if there's an alternative for it, then I think it should be actively pursued.
Absolutely. You know, I was reading in Psychology Today a couple of months ago, of course, that more and more women over 50 are the ones that are initiating the divorce. And I actually had an attorney and I had a psychologist on the show. And what was really interesting to hear from these two men was that the men apparently were just absolutely blindsided. They thought that they were doing everything right, and it was their wives that had the affairs, and it was their wives that did not want to work anything out, and it was their wives who said, we are done. And these men apparently were just like, oh my God, what's happened? I thought things were really okay.
Well, you know, we've seen the emergence of men's groups and even men's divorce groups over the past 20, 25 years. We've also seen an emergence of more women groups, because I think women's groups for this kind of scenario came before the men's groups. So we have groups that are certain that the bad things in divorce have been initiated by the other side. Unfortunately, there are no exact statistics on this. Nobody knows for sure. If you lined up 1,000 divorce participants, who did what to whom first? However, I am like to stick to my guns on the idea that, in my experience, that women are often disadvantaged because, if for no other reason, they don't have the economic clout to start a divorce and get it off the ground the way a lot of men do. And as a result, I've developed a lot of techniques in my own practice, in my own firm, of evening the playing field. And you hear this expression in the case law as well. There's an ideal out there that the playing field, so to speak, should be level, shouldn't it, between men and women in divorce. No one particular gender should have any kind of advantage. And even though there have been some very eloquent legal opinions written by our highest court on this issue, the disparity still exists. Laws themselves are not enough to equal the playing field. You need lawyers who have gone to the mat on this issue many, many times, and defended female clients in court. And of course, I've done that for many years. So I will say there, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree a little bit with your male, attorney guys, because I still think that it's still very much a man's world when it comes to divorce.
And I think that, you know, one of the things that I see as a therapist is that people, not only do they oftentimes wait too long, and of course I'm not representative at all, because most people don't go into therapy. So I only see the people who at least initially appear to be motivated to try and see whether or not they can't fix the problems in their marriage. But I think that, you know, one of the things is that people do they wait too long to deal with their issues. I mean, issues arise in all of our lives, and when we see that, you know, we're going around on a merry-go-round, or we're on a roller coaster ride and not fun rides, I think people are still very, very reluctant to reach out and ask for help.
Yeah, it's human nature to avoid conflict, mm-hmm. and to avoid looking in the mirror and saying, this needs to be fixed. I think it's just part and parcel of what it is to be a human being. As I tell my son Jackson, young 26-year-old man, our minds and our brains are not programmed for smooth functioning and happiness lifelong. We have to work with ourselves as people. That's why therapists are so indispensable to the human condition, without sounding too highfalutin about it. Everybody needs a certain professional at some point in their life. We all need doctors. We all need lawyers. We all need therapists. Or at least hopefully when we know that we have an issue that needs working on. And I've seen it in my practice time and again, and I know my therapist friends have. There's a big resistance to fixing what needs to be fixing. I don't really know all the reasons why. I know a few of them, but that's where we come in as professionals, whether it's legal or medical, financial or psychological. If we care about our clients as people, we need to say, okay, I can't really force you to do this, and it's not my job to do so. But what I can tell you is that this is what's likely to happen to you if you don't address this situation.
And of course, the thing too is that, you know, I've been preaching for years about relationship education. And when I finished my graduate and postgraduate work at McGill, I ran with two other people the entire school social services program for Greater Montreal. So there were hundreds of schools and staff, and we didn't worry about money and insurance. And of course, we are the kinder, gentler educational system, and I believe the kinder, gentler country. But I was able, and I had carte blanche, to design and implement relationship education programs beginning in the kindergarten level that went throughout high school. And what was very interesting, and I think I have not talked about this publicly on radio and television, but when I lived in Florida, Governor Jeb Bush appointed me to the Florida State Commission on Marriage and Family Support Initiatives. His daughter was going through some issues. I was with ABC TV, and one day I'm calling my answering service, and there is a message from Jeb, who says, "Hey, Beatty, it is Jeb Bush." And it's funny, I had my husband listen to the message, and of course, I got back to him. And the idea at the time was that my relationship education program, the hope was, is that it was going to be implemented in high schools and in colleges throughout the state of Florida. So I became Commissioner Cohan for a couple of terms. But I'll tell you what the truth was about being Commissioner Cohan. I met with everybody, Dan, all the major decision makers, including Jeb Bush in the state of Florida, people in education, people in social services, people in the domestic violence world. And I got to tell you, after 2 years, I was very, very clear that nobody gave a damn. And that was the truth. People, they talked about the importance of relationship education. They talked about how are we going to find a way to diminish the domestic violence statistics. And of course, we're always coming in after the fact. It's always a crisis intervention, you know, kind of a modality that's used. And it was really an eye-opener to me because I felt that Governor Bush was serious, and that everybody else in the decision-making capacities in education and social services, that they were serious too, but they were not. You know who cared? The guidance counselors cared, and they were the ones that had no power. The teachers cared. The administrators of all the school boards couldn't have cared less. And this is really the dilemma. You know, we're waiting for kids. We're waiting for all of us to really learn the ABCs of successful relationships so that we're going to be able to make the most, at least I believe, the most important decisions in our lives about if we choose to marry. You know, it's our spouse, it's family, it's not just love and lust. And yet we are ill prepared for the most important decisions in our life. And that was my experience. And I will also say that I was probably the first commissioner who was never reappointed. I made a real fuss about all of this and really confronted everybody. And nobody really had anything to say because they knew and I knew. And universities across the country, I mean, there are certainly schools that are preaching relationship education of sorts, but nothing that's particularly significant and substantial on an ongoing basis.
I hear you.
So, yeah, and so this is why, you know, people are ending up in your offices. The divorce rate for second marriages is 63%. Now, are you finding also that people who are coming to see you, that this is a second divorce and it is a third divorce?
Yeah, I don't know what the numbers are in terms of New York City law practices, but I can tell you that a large number of second marriages do come in. I think what we're also seeing now with the baby boom set, of which I'm a proud member, is that there's been divorce has lost whatever stigma. It did have a large stigma even in my lifetime, but it's lost among baby boomers, I think, close to all of its stigma, and people have no problems assuming they can confront their fears and anxieties and approach a lawyer or a good divorce therapist. They have no problem if something is the stigma being gone. They will come in their 50s and say, this is not working. Please get me divorced and, you know, get me out of this.
Well, I think part of the reason, of course, is that A, they don't know the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship and that they have not really done a good assessment. And one of the things that I had found particularly frustrating with my research, because people who know me know that in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you will ever, ever want to meet. Professionally, I am incredibly patient, but that my research found that it takes close to a year using my formula to really find out who somebody is and isn't, and that all we can say initially when we meet somebody is that the person appears to be lovely and trustworthy and smart and honest and all of these things. And it's kind of like playing out the points of a tennis match. You've got to play it out. And unfortunately, we can't fast forward this process as much as we would like to, you know. And I think that, you know, in our society, we want it now. We want it yesterday. We want to just click, you know, click right, click left, do something really, really quickly without really playing it all out. And people, of course, are facing serious and dire consequences in their personal lives, of course, professionally as well, when we don't play out these points of the match.
I agree, and attention span is a shrinking idea now. It's very difficult to get anybody's attention for any period of time, and in my practice and yours as well, it doesn't really work that way. People are their best friends if they learn to slow down a bit and let themselves be helped, and you're right. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes an investment of time and energy to work out what's going to be best in your life. The whole idea, I think it's incredible that you've hit on this, of using an actual method to assess who your mate is going to be is groundbreaking, and I think it's amazing. Of course, you're about to put me out of business, but that's okay.
Well, we can collaborate together, you know, but no, the way the whole thing actually happened is that I had a private practice in Providence, Rhode Island, and many of the people that I was treating at the time were Brown University students. The Brown University was about two blocks away from my office. And what I realized, here were these, you know, brilliant, lovely, you know, kids that knew absolutely nothing about relationships like most of us. I mean, believe me, Dan, I wish that I had had my formula when I started dating many, many, many years ago, that it would have helped me avoid a lot of disappointments. And, you know, it just, but, you know, what was, and it just struck me, though, on one particular day, that the exact same kind of assessment that I do when people come to see me, I have to find out who they are, I have to find out about their history, I have to find out all kinds of things about them, that it is the identical kind of assessment that you and I need to use if we are going to be assessing people in our lives. And that was how the whole thing came about. And of course, I did the research, and now, I mean, I can't not use it, whether or not, I mean, I'm happily married, thank goodness, but, you know, I use this with everything that I do, so that, you know, for me, when I meet people, whether it's colleagues or anybody, it's always about going through this assessment process and making sure that I don't allow my emotions to just kind of take over. And it, you're right, when you talk about the need to slow down, just to slow the whole process down. And this is where I still feel that the relationship does need to be the icing on the cake. You know,
I agree.
It's fun, it's tasty, but that we need to be okay with or without the icing, with or without the relationship. In fact, I was reading over the weekend, and I love Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett is talking, I don't know whether you've ever read any of his articles, you know, more and more about the importance of personal relationships. So here was something that I found over the weekend. So this is what he says. He says, marry the right person. Buffett made his fortune through smart investing, but if you ask him about the most important decision he ever made, it would have nothing to do with money. So he says, the biggest decision of your life is to who you choose to marry. Right? And I mean, who could disagree with anything like that? And then there was a Harvard study that I talk about. I talk about this a lot because I'm hoping all the people, you know, who listen to the Ask Beattie show will really take all this in. So there was another Harvard study that was done. The biggest study, it was an 80-year study that says that the one thing that will make you happier and healthier in life, according to Dr. Robert Waldinger, who's a psychiatrist and who is currently directing the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which is one of the most comprehensive studies of emotional well-being in history. So this is not a slouchy guy. So he says that the one message that came through loud and clear, good relationships keep us happier and healthier, period. End of story. So that it isn't, you know, it isn't the money and the bigger and the better and the yachts and the planes. And, you know, you and I both, I mean, I have treated some of the wealthiest people in the United States when I was living in Sarasota. And all I can tell you is that the planes and the jewelry, it does it for the day. And then you have to come back to reality and deal with the issues, right? You know, and there's absolutely no way around it.
Right.
And so you agree.
I couldn't agree more. You know, we're not programmed to necessarily stay with the same spouse year after year. We need a method. People think that by changing partners, they're going to fix their lives.
Right.
And what they really need to be doing is examining themselves the way you do, the way you teach them to do. And you've developed an actual method to do that, which is outstanding.
And it's not fun. And, you know, one of the things that I joke with people and I say that I'm apologizing, but not really, is that this isn't sexy. It isn't sexy to be talking about the importance of emotional communication and emotional problem solving and emotional intimacy and helping people to understand the difference between sex and emotional intimacy. And we all want a great sex life, but a great sex life without great emotional intimacy and wonderful problem solving and communication skills, it's not going to make it long term. And people really need to understand this. And when you look at, you know, people's abilities or lack of abilities when it comes to communication and problem solving, we all need help in this particular area. And yet, how many people, I mean, when I think over the years, Dan, nobody has ever called and said, I need help with emotional communication and problem solving. It never happens. Well, listen, I just got word from my producer that our time is basically up, and I want people to be able to reach you, okay? And so my guest, Daniel Stock, you really need to call him when you want a consult about a possible divorce. And his telephone number is area code 475-232-4105. And you all, of course, can go to the Ask Beattie archives on the Progressive Radio Network. You can hear the show if you haven't been able to hear the show live today. And you can get all of Daniel Stock's contact information. So listen, Dan, I really want to thank you so much for coming in. I hope you've had a good experience. experience.
Thanks, Petey. I totally have.
Good, good. And we'll continue our conversations. And for those of you who tune in every single week, I want to thank you so much for listening and for emailing and for texting. And we can always discuss and we can debate all the issues that I talk about here on the Ask Petey Show. And every week, I leave people with two messages, Dan. And the first message is that we all have to find a much better way to learn to love ourselves and do what is in our best interest and engage in constructive kinds of behavior. And secondly, we really in our society need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to love each other.